All right, so yes, I am not Lisa Zerdin. I am Corey Davis. I am not a social worker. I'm a lawyer. Please don't hold that against me. So I'm going to talk about, we'll go through it. We have to give the disclosure. We have nothing to disclose, no financial relationships. And I would say this is research that we are reporting on. It's not research that we conducted. We've done the analysis of already existing data. Lisa and I are on the board of directors of the organization that did the research. So we submitted to the IRB and got an exemption because we're just, it's already existing data. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the effects of policing on HIV transmission among injection drug users. These are kind of social determinants. We're going to talk about previous interventions that have worked with police to try to change their practice that affects bloodborne disease risk, particularly among injection drug users, although not exclusively. And then we're going to talk about the results of this training that's been conducted and is still ongoing in North Carolina. Like I said, we didn't have anything to do with conducting that research. We're just talking about the data. So the backgrounds, HIV in the United States South. As you probably know, the United States South has the highest rates of new HIV infections in the country, the highest number of AIDS deaths per capita in the country, and the highest number of adults and adolescents living with HIV/AIDS in the country. There are obviously a number of reasons for that, including higher levels of poverty, which translates into lack of access to health care, and there are other reasons for lack of access to health care. It's also partly a result of criminal justice policy, prison policy, policing policy. We're going to talk about one particular angle of that. I think about the role of law in bloodborne disease transmission among injection drug users. The laws criminalizing and stigmatizing, I'm just going to call it folks, I'm going to say IDUs, right? People who use injection drugs, illicit injection drugs, or legal drugs illicitly. Police practice can affect HIV transmission risk among IDUs. Laws on the, what we call laws on the books, can also mediate that risk, can change the risk, particularly of street people who are using drugs on the street, not necessarily street-based homeless people or homeless people, but people particularly who do not have a safe place to go to and use drugs. So typically poorer people, people who are living more chaotic lives, people who are out in the open where police can see them. So you've got these laws on the books, we call law on the streets, right? So you've got the actual law, and you've got the way the law is put into practice. They're correlated. Sometimes that correlation is strong. Sometimes it's relatively weak, right? I'm going to get into that in a little more detail. So law enforcement practice, and what that means is what the police do when they're out on the beat, what they do when they're out driving around or walking around the neighborhood. They can increase bloodborne disease risk among IDUs by a number of ways. And they're kind of obvious, but I'll go through them. Deter uptake of preventive services. What the thinking there is, it's discouraging people from, for example, accessing syringe exchange programs. We don't have any legal syringe exchange programs in North Carolina, but there's good evidence from other states that that happens. Reduce access to sterile syringes in other ways by discouraging people from carrying them, by being a presence around a pharmacy where people might go in and buy them, by all kinds of ways. Pushes people to locations poorly suited for hygienic injection. And this is the idea that if drug use and carrying syringes is criminalized, you want to go get the drug and you want to get it in you as quickly as possible. You want to reduce the risk that you're going to get caught with it, arrested, prosecuted. So you go grab it, you're going to duck into a dark alleyway. Obviously, you're not everybody does this, but on average, it's going to push people into places that are bad from a public health perspective for them to be using the drugs. increases improperly discarded syringes, same thing. You don't want to get caught with the syringes on you. It's illegal to carry the syringe, or it's perceived to be illegal by either or both parties to carry the syringe. And it keeps people from summoning emergency response and overdose. In general, these negative health impacts aren't intended. Police don't start their shift and go out and say, hey, let's see if we can increase the chance that somebody's going to get HIV today. Right? These are unintended consequences of the things that of the laws on the books and the way that they're implemented. When you talk to police about it, they'll say, you know, I'm just doing my job. You know, this is what I'm supposed to do. Police also tend to see drug use through the lens of criminality, right? There's good evidence that the people who become police officers have a certain viewpoint on life, and they go through police training. You're trained to see the world in a particular way. And it's not a public health perspective. It's certainly not a social work perspective. It's almost like an us and them perspective. You're constantly evaluating people you see. Are they with us or are they against us? And drug use is criminalized. Drug users are criminalized. They're the other, right? So you deal with them in a particular way. We also find that police officers are often unaware of existing laws. For example, in North Carolina, you don't need a prescription to buy a syringe. Anybody can walk into a pharmacy and just buy a syringe. And it's not illegal to carry that syringe in and of itself. Most officers don't know that. And of course, you know, they're often unaware that all of this is going on. They're just out there doing their job. So there are two main types of interventions that have been done to try to reduce, we call police-mediated HIV risk, all of this stuff I've just been talking about. How do we move that dial a little bit over here? You can change the law in the books, right? You can, for example, explicitly authorize syringe exchange programs, and that's been done in a number of states, not in North Carolina. You can explicitly authorize pharmacy purchase of syringes. North Carolina has done that. I think there's only one remaining state where you can't just go into a syringe or go into a pharmacy and buy a syringe without a prescription. Or you can change what's called the law on the streets, right? The laws haven't changed, but you can still change the way police practice, how they do their work, how they go about their daily existence. Changing law in the books can be really effective. It can also be really difficult and time-consuming, particularly around drug use, particularly in the South, right? Luckily, there is good evidence that police are receptive to training around the evidence basis for changing practice. We call the law on the streets, how they actually interact with drug users. And there's some evidence that that training can actually affect the way they go about doing their jobs. There's not too much of this that's been done, but the stuff that's been done suggests that that training is particularly effective when you start out by talking about the public health basis, why it's important that they at least think about what they're doing and the effects that it has. When it's conducted by a trusted source, or it's not just somebody coming in and telling them how to do their job, someone who's not a cop telling them how to be cops, they don't like that. Nobody likes that, right? I mean, none of this is specific to law enforcement. And the focus is on the benefits to them, right? Here's why you should do it, not because you're going to, you know, help the dirty druggies, but here's what's in it for you, right? So that's the background. Based on that, this NGO in North Carolina, which I said we're on the board of, decided to try to do a training with police officers, right? Knowing that it's difficult to change the law, and it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. But maybe, you know, the thinking is we can work with the police and try to get them to change that practice, you know, called a law on the streets. So we've been looking for a way to do this, and they found the inn, right? They went and talked to a statewide CIT meeting, and CIT is the crisis intervention teams, and I think every state or most states have these teams, and what they are typically are sometimes they're interdisciplinary collaborations between police and non-police people. In North Carolina, they are specially trained police officers who are given extra training in, you know, mental health, in sort of social worky type things. And the genesis of this really was they found that police officers were doing a little too much of shooting schizophrenic people. Was really what was going on. I mean, honestly, I mean, that's what was going on. So instead of changing how police academy works in general, what they decided was they would pick people from every department, and it depending, you know, some people will volunteer, some people are picked, most people are volunteers, to go to the special training, you know, to learn how to work better with people who may have mental illness, people who may be using drugs, right? So the regular officers, when they come into contact with one of those people, are supposed to call, you know, for the CIT team to come, you know, hopefully work with those people in a more productive way than shooting them. So anyway, people from the NGO went to this statewide meeting of these crisis intervention team trainers and just talked to them, just a general overview, not of this project, but just what the organization does and the resources available to this organization. And through that, sort of pitched this idea to a leader in the organization. And she was intrigued and got them on the training calendar. So what happens for the CIT training, it's a five-day training. It's a 40-hour week training. So I said, you know, we'll give you an hour on our next one for these three departments. You know, come talk. And through that, it spread, and it's now part of this training. So it's now been done with almost 50 different departments throughout the state. So here's what it is. It's conducted by someone from the nonprofit, as well as former law enforcement officers, and that's based on this idea that, you know, cops don't like being talked at. You know, they don't like some, you know, do-gooder coming in and telling them how to do their work. So here's one of the trainers. This is Ron. Ron is a retired NYPD detective. You know, he's a real deal. He looks like a cop. He talks like a cop, and he can go in and talk to cops. So he does part of the training. Like I said, it's only about an hour in length, and it's integrated into the regular thing that these guys are going and ladies are going to anyway. It covers an overview of drug use and bloodborne disease, basically, you know, facts and stats about the seriousness of the problem, basics of HIV transmission. You would be surprised how much people don't know about how HIV is transmitted. The current state of syringe prescription law, and not just the idea that you can go into any pharmacy in the state and buy a syringe. It's not illegal to do that. General bloodborne exposure risk reduction, and like I said, a focus on the risk of needle stick injury to law enforcement. And just on that, you know, so the idea there is you're trying to get the officers to believe what the evidence says, which is that if someone who is using a syringe to inject drugs has access to a steady source of clean syringes, they will use them, and that will reduce the risk that if that officer is stuck, which is something that, we'll see, officers really worry about, it's much less likely that they're going to get infected, that needle is going to be contaminated, right? It seems obvious, but if nobody's ever told you that, you probably haven't thought about it. Okay, so did it work? So pre and post tests, relatively simple pre and post tests, self-report, voluntary, anonymous, they're conducted and collected by the NGO staff, four demographic questions, age, race, sex, years on the force, and 16 questions, attitudinal questions. It was given before, after the training, immediately after, post-test, same, but with two questions asking people, essentially, did they find the training useful, and do they think that it should be given to everybody? Likert scale, four categories, from strongly disagree to strongly agree. So here's the socio-demographics. Skew a little older, almost 40 was the average age, about 80% male. Actually an okay distribution of among race, and the average years on the force was about 10. First question we asked them, or they were asked, is if they've ever been stuck by a needle, and about 6% said that they had, and we don't know if that's high or not. I mean, it seems really high. It seems really high. I'll just say that. It seems really high. But, you know, from an epidemiological standpoint, maybe it's not particularly high, because you have to remember we're talking about 280 officers over an average of 11 years on the force, right? So your lifetime risk is 6%. Any individual officer's risk is still extremely low, right? So it's how to lie with statistics. But we'll say it's relatively high. It's certainly not non-existent. And another 3% said that they had ever been cut by a crack pipe or a methamphetamine pipe. Among those who had been stuck or cut, there was a follow-up question. When you received that injury, were you worried about contracting HIV or hepatitis C virus? And 14, almost 9 out of 10 people said yes, I was worried. So just going to give you, like I said, this is self-report data. These are the results of the questions that they were asked. So here's getting HIV from drug users is a big concern for me as an officer. The blue is the pretest, the red is the post-test. So you can see these guys are really, really scared about getting HIV from drug users. And we know that, you know, so the lifetime risk of getting stuck is 6%. We know that your chances of getting HIV from a needle stick injury are vanishingly low. There's actually never been a reported case of a law enforcement officer getting HIV. So in that sense, their worry is much greater than the actual risk, right? But they're scared to death, right? And after the training, they actually said that they're more worried. And we think that that's just because it's on their brain, right? They weren't really coming to the training, they weren't really thinking about it. But then they hear all these facts and stats about, you know, how bad HIV is in the South, and they're even more worried about it. So that's sort of the background, right? They're really worried about it. So then we ask them these questions. I would say part of, you know, one of the things that is kind of intertwined in the training, and again, I stress that we didn't design or do the training, it was done by this NGO, was trying to push them towards this idea that syringes should be decriminalized in the state, right? Not just from pharmacies, but it just shouldn't be a crime at all to carry a syringe. I've seen the training, they never explicitly say that, but it's kind of like built around that idea. Right, so that's why these questions are asking about that. So statewide syringe decriminalization would promote drug use. And you see, you know, this training changed the self-reported attitudes to that question, right? Before, you had people who, you know, strongly disagreed, and afterwards they had kind of moved over to the agree column, right? My impression of syringe decriminalization is generally positive. You had this big shift from disagree to agree. These aren't matched responses, right? So these are just mean responses. We're not actually looking at individual officers' reports. These are means, or these are aggregates. Sorry. So this training was effective in moving their self-reported impressions of syringe decriminalization. Syringe decriminalization would help reduce HIV, right? Look at this huge change from disagree to agree. And I think that's just education. They just never thought about it. Just never thought about how HIV is transmitted. I'm getting the one minute warning. So I will just say that the rest of these go on in that vein. And then at the end, we asked them if it was useful or helpful, and most of the people said yes, and most of them thought that it should be integrated into the law enforcement training. So here's what we found. On average, these officers are extremely worried about contracting bloodborne disease, but they really don't believe that decriminalization of syringes would increase drug use. They do believe that decriminalization of syringes would reduce HIV risk. They found the training useful. Why is this important? Because people in general have these ideas about police, tend to think, and people that we talk to, we don't have, you know, actual data on this, but people we talk to tend to think, you know, cops, they are how they are, they're never going to change. They're not going to like this idea of syringe decriminalization, and you're not going to change their minds, certainly not by just talking to them for 50 minutes. But we found that's not true, and this builds on a number of previous studies that have shown similar things. Police are interested in learning about this stuff. They have a really low level of knowledge starting out. You can increase their level of knowledge, and you can kind of move at least their self-reported, you know, opinions of syringe decriminalization. That's all I got. Thank you.